Well, now we are ready to begin tonight's session, and I am delighted to introduce our presenter, Jeannie Crowley. Jeannie Crowley is the manager of digital media and learning at Bank Street College. Her background includes years as a K-12 special education teacher and teacher trainer in the Bronx. With master's degrees in both elementary education and digital media, she works with educators to create innovative, constructivist digital learning experience for students. She received the Samsung Hope for Education and ING Unsung Heroes Awards for her work with young children and technology. I'm also happy to introduce Betsy, who will be facilitating tonight the technical aspects of tonight's webinar. And Jeannie, the floor is now yours.
Thank you so much, Judith. Thank you all for joining me tonight. And I just want to let you know, normally I have my headset on and I can type along in the chat as I go along. But tonight I'm calling in on my phone, so I only have one hand free. So if you have a question in chat and it's not picked up right away, either Judith or Stephanie will bring it to my attention, and I'll make sure to attend to it. And if at any point you would like me to stop and repeat something or go a little bit more slowly, or if you are having trouble hearing the audio, just let me know during chat and I'll be able to pick up on that. So tonight our session is about active versus passive media with young children. And we're going to learn a little bit about the different types of screen time that young children are exposed to, especially with a specific emphasis on the fact that just because they're looking at a screen, there are variances within what the quality of that activity is. If you attended our last webinar, it's a very brief recap about how much screen time is really the max for children of any age. We'll learn about the challenges facing young tech users, specifically around the ideas of digital natives, the big ideas for active and participatory technology, and we'll have a few sample projects you can use with your family right now. The biggest thing about the sample projects that I'll be bringing up towards the second half of the webinar is we're more interested in developing a framework for how to use technology with young children rather than developing a set of very specific guidelines. So all the things that I'm mentioning throughout this webinar, you don't have to follow everyone like a checklist. It's more developing a bigger understanding of how technology works and how you can use it with young children. So it's really important to note that most of the things that I'm talking about this evening, in fact, all of the things I'm talking about this evening, are for children who are 3 and older. The American Pediatrics Association found no benefit for passive media in children under 2. Children under 2 just don't learn very efficiently from interacting with the computer. So although they may learn their alphabet from watching a video, it may take much, much longer than learning the alphabet by doing interactions with a human being. They haven't done a ton of research about, you know, what we're going to explore more shortly is active media. So just to be safe, it's better to avoid media whenever possible for children under 2, unless you just really need a break or there's rare circumstances. It's not a good educational tool for very, very young children. Children even older than 2 years old, the 3 and up range, should not have more than 2 hours per day. And that 2 hours per day encompasses all screen time. That includes video, homework, looking at educational content. All of that together equals the 2 hours. And that's sometimes hard to think of because you might think of your slightly older children, 7 or 8 years old, spending a long time doing homework. But the reason they try to limit to 2 hours a day is because there are opportunity costs associated with that. So the 2 hours that they're spending on the computer, they're not up, they're not moving, they're not outside, they're not having face-to-face interactions with peer and family. So the 2 hours is really more of an opportunity cost rather than saying that the 2 hours that you're spending doesn't have any value at all. The fourth point is just to remember to calculate total amount of screen time. So we tend to think of the 2 hours as a 1 2-hour marathon session, but it could be 5 minutes here that with an iPad on the subway, could be 10 minutes doing homework, could be a half hour watching TV. So when you're thinking about how much time your child's actually spending looking at a screen, remember to bring all of the content together into one cumulative assessment. And the final thing to recap before we really delve into the difference between passive and active media is that they've done very many recent surveys, and Common Sense Media is the foundation that surveys how much children are spending online. And children 8 or younger are consistently spending more than 2 hours. So it's something that we know is a problem we're trying to address, but it's something that, you know, about 2.5 hours is about the average range. So you know that some children are spending less and some children are spending a lot more, but overall kind of our group goal is to get them under 2 hours a day.
Jeannie, there's a question in another section. Can you see it? Okay,
yep.
Great.
So we had a question that says, does that include screen time in school? And yes, it's 2 hours in totality. And I know that seems like a very low number. So I'm just to recap the question, one of our participants says, you know, does the 2 hours that we say that we should limit for children include the entire day, both school and home? And it is. So during our last webinar, one of the things we talked about was how much time they're spending on screen time. You really have to talk to other caregivers and teachers and educators to get a better idea of how much time they're spending. And then another follow-up question from participants that said, when kids use smart boards all day, how does that factor in? Well, that's a really important part of it, and it depends on how they're using the smart board. So if all the kids are sitting in a chair looking at the smart board the entire day, that would count as 8 hours of screen time. It would be no different functionally than sitting in your chair and watching a video, even though it's they may be doing cognitively active tasks and talking. It's important to think about how it's broken up. So are they doing 5 minutes on the smart board, then they're having a whole group discussion, then they're going back for 10 minutes, and then they go back to small group work? I think actually looking at how the activities flow will give you a better idea of exactly how much time they're spending on the screen. And that's a conversation you can really have with the teacher. I find that having been in the classroom, it's very rare that the teacher is at the front of the room for, you know, 45 minutes or an hour and a half with a smart board just running and the kids not doing anything else. So having that more in-depth discussion about what exactly do these classes look like and how much time are they looking just at the board and how much time are they actually talking to each other is a really important part. And then another follow-up question, so does that include things like Leapster educational games and computer games with tracing letters? And yes, it includes all of that. Essentially, the American Pediatrics Association said that regardless of what you're doing, whether it's a purely cartoons for 2 hours or something really amazingly interactive and educational for 2 hours, that 2 hours sitting in a chair is the max of really how much they should have when they're not interacting socially with other peers or up and running around. So they look at it more as an opportunity cost than a value statement about what they're doing with that screen time. So a follow-up question said, so if an 8-hour school day, the kids spend 2 hours on the smart board, they should not have screen time at home. And yeah, that's, you know, you might want to push the limit and give them 20 minutes and you're really kind of going beyond the external boundary of that 2 hours. But they would say that the American Pediatrics Association would say if they've met the 2 hours during the day at school, then that's the limit for the day. The rest of the day at home should not have additional screen time. And I'll just take one more question on this slide, and then I move on. It says, does Kindle books count as reading time or screen time? I actually don't know the answer to that question, I have to be honest. And I'll follow up and I'll send out an email to Judith afterwards because, you know, that's literacy and that's reading, and that might be a different area. I'm not 100% certain because I don't know if they've done research because that's not my area of expertise, I have to admit, of, you know, children who spend 8 hours a day reading a book versus children who spend 2 hours reading a book and then 3 hours playing in the jungle gym. So I'm going to defer that one, and I will follow up and find out the research on that so I don't give you just kind of a non-supported answer. And I'll send that to Judith, I would say, if you wanted to send it to the group after the webinar. I'll make sure to provide that information.
Great.
Okay. So a big thing about young tech users, and this is the what we call the digital native myth. So the idea of a digital native came out, I think it was right around when the Internet started coming out. And it was actually unscientifically supported, but it's really stuck, this idea that young children who grew up with the Internet are inherently better at using the Internet and technology. But what they found, and I'm going to read this quote, it's from 2005, but it's really persisted today, that children and young people are divided into two groups. Essentially, those for whom the Internet is rich, diverse, engaging, stimulating, it's really important resource in life, and those for the other group who it's very narrow, unengaging, and occasionally useful. And the reason that this quote, I chose it really purposely, is, you know, maybe 10 or 15 years ago, we looked at participation gap as students who had Internet and students who didn't have Internet. And what we're really looking at, the participation gap, especially for young children now, is for children, many, many children, especially in America, have Internet access. It's more of children who have the Internet and understand how to use it in a way that really works for them and how to contribute to it, versus children who see the internet as this static entity, almost like an encyclopedia, where they get things from it and they consume content, but they're not really part of it and they don't really use it to its fullest potential. So the challenges for young tech users, you know, these so-called digital natives, and when we were practicing for this webinar, this came up, this is something that a lot of adults also express challenges with as well, is there's three main areas where there are challenges. First one is the participation gap. So while it used to be not having internet access, now it's not really having the knowledge or the skills to really utilize and contribute to the internet. So when we talk about the participation gap, we're really focusing more on that knowledge gap than the access gap. The second area is the transparency problem. Now, this is a really interesting one because not understanding how the internet works or how information is created on the internet or how to use the internet for learning or how it can contribute to your own learning and cognitive processes is actually a really difficult thing to explain because it's something that many of us struggle with. And so essentially, many young users view the internet as a place where information is and they go to get it, but they don't understand how the information gets there, so they tend to think of the information as true without questioning it. So we try to make the entire internet more transparent through some of the activities we'll be talking about so that young learners understand that things on the internet are created by people and people have their own agendas or their own faults that may contribute to the truthfulness or veracity of the information on the internet. I do see a question that says, I'm just going to pause for a second. My school encourages smart board use in Hebrew and English classes. If I request internet research or my students do research on their own, they're automatically over the limit. How do I get them to use the internet in a positive way? So we're going to talk a little bit. This is very challenging. So the question is, if I have to do internet research, during a typical day, I'm not 100% sure, would they be doing 2 hours of research all at once during the school day? And we'll talk a little bit more about that transparency problem as it relates to information research. But Chaya, if you can just follow up in the notes about how much during the school day you expect them actually doing research, that would be helpful. And the third area where young tech users struggle is the ethics challenge. Now, this is really, in our next webinar, we'll be talking about this a little bit more. This is not applying our normal socialization rules to online spaces. So this is essentially, you know, we know how to interact with our peers and how to be kind and how to respect their property, but we have a really hard time doing that when we move into online spaces. And often what this does is it leads to bullying, to copyright infringement, to unintentional theft of digital property. We won't focus too much on that during this webinar, but I did want to mention that it was an area where young learners and sometimes adult learners still struggle. So I just want to recap what I mean by passive screen time before I move a little bit more into active screen time. So passive screen time is, you know, your child is alone in front of the TV, your child zoning out, not responding. So the information is going in, but they're not really processing the information. They're consuming and not creating. So they may be watching something, and they may be looking at something, but they're not processing it, they're not asking questions, they're not contributing their own take onto it. Another element of passive screen time is, especially if they're very young, if you're watching it, they're watching it. So you might be watching a news show, and that counts as their screen time if they're in the room as well. So they're not really cognitively able to process, you know, an evening news show, but it still counts as them sitting looking at the screen. Likewise, if your child's being distracted from other activities while you're watching a movie or TV in the background. And a really important thing about the passive screen time is thinking about it as the, a lot of us are very familiar with, the information into the box approach with education. So even if it's a very, very good educational video, if there's no real opportunity for the child to process or question or think about what's coming at them, if the video is just playing and going straight into them, that's not a really great way for information to be kind of pushed into the brains of children. I mean, that's kind of like an older model of education, but that's more like the passive screen time model. Now, in contrast, you have active screen time, which means your child is creating, they're participating, they're talking about their learning, so they're starting to make those connections about learning, how they learn. And many of us adults have these meta-awareness, the metacognition, to know what learning preferences we have, such as, I like videos better, I prefer text, I like images, I like it when someone talks to me versus when someone writes something down. And so part of this is actually talking about the things that they prefer through the learning process, and they're learning about their own learning during active screen time. Another element is they're asking critical questions about technology and information. So it's not just accepting what's coming through the screen, it's stopping and thinking, well, does that make sense? Is that true? Is that something I believe? Where did that information come from? Do I have a different point of view? This one is really an important one, with the idea that it can be closed-ended or open-ended. And the reason I bring that up is there's different types of active screen time, and a parallel I often draw is the closed-ended versus open-ended activities that we do with our children at face-to-face. So you might have puzzles as a closed-ended activity. It has value and you have a goal, but you might have more open-ended activity like blocks. And you might always do one or always do the other. You'd like to mix it up. And so that's one of the things we think about with active screen time. A closed-ended activity might be an educational video about volcanoes that you're discussing very much in depth together while they're watching it. Or it might be a website that helps them learn letters or multiplication. And in contrast, an open activity might be something that lets them be a little bit more creative, and they can kind of choose their own learning path. And then finally, connections are made between the internet and the real world that they aren't mutually exclusive. And this is a really big concept for young children and for adults, is that there are things on the internet that represent the real world, and there's things on the internet that impact the real world, and I don't have to do activities that are on the internet that stay on the internet. I can do things in my real life and put them on the internet, or I can see things on the internet and go try them out in my real life. So understanding that they're connected is an important part of active screen time. Does anybody have any questions about that distinction between the closed, opened area? So I'm going to give you some more specific framing ideas in the next slide. But a few tips I try to suggest when selecting technology for active and open-ended projects. And I'm going to focus more exclusively on the open-ended projects rather than the closed-ended, because the closed-ended projects are more straightforward. You know, they're trying to learn something very specific, multiplication, letters, a very specific subject for science. And I think those are easier to kind of delve into independently. Melissa said, would you consider YouTube research and internet passive or active? I would consider research active if it's done correctly. So I think research anywhere where a kid is asking questions and exploring knowledge is definitely active. If you select the video for them, and they don't know why they're watching the video and you just hit play, then that is passive. So really you can take the exact same piece of content and it can be passive or active depending upon the activity, the way the activity was designed around it. So just to revisit, you have a YouTube video, you found it, you hit play, they ask no questions, kind of go straight in their brain. That would be more of a passive interaction versus they ask the questions, they came to the video, they evaluated not. It was a video they wanted to watch, they looked at it, they determined whether or not it was a valid piece of information, and they talked about it, that would be more active. So a few tips for selecting technology for active and open-ended projects. The first one is technology that grows. So what I mean by that is the closed-ended projects that you have, which have value at a very specific time and place, so the multiplication table websites, Starfall, those sorts of things, your children outgrow them. So after they've learned how to use them and the knowledge doesn't really apply to them anymore, they can't really use that site anymore. So we try to think of using projects when they're very young that that they'll be able to change where it goes when they get older. So, you know, YouTube is an example. They can use that when they were 3 and 4 and use it in a very, very different way when they're 8 or 9, but they haven't outgrown its usefulness. Another one, tip that I try to use is selecting open-ended technology. So what this means is technology allows the child to choose different ways of using it rather than one set path. So to continue with the YouTube example, they can look at videos, they can contribute videos, they can remix videos that are there, they can explore a variety of different subject areas. So they have a lot more control over where they can go, and they have a lot more options about where they can go versus if they go to a site that's only about volcanoes. So that still is informational, but it's not open-ended. Another one is tech that allows you to create. A really nice option with these more open-ended technology sites is thinking about whether or not your child is making something or simply looking at something others have made for them. So we want to start moving some of our projects more towards your child being a creator rather than a consumer. And that's a really big shift, not just using the internet to get information, but using the internet as a place to share information and knowledge that you have. And that's really, really powerful for children of any age, because it validates that they have something to offer to others. So it's not just about saying, somebody else has created this and I'm taking it in. Wait, I have something to contribute, and I'm going to share it with people too. And the final part is tech that allows you to model and ask questions around the three areas of concern. So the participation, transparency, and ethics that I mentioned earlier, it's not about hitting on all three every single time. It's more about having an awareness that those struggles exist, and how can you ask questions and frame the way you talk about technology to have opportunities to highlight learning in those areas. So a more face-to-face example, if you're using painting with young children, there's some very specific questions you might ask with painting with young children to encourage it to be open-ended. You might, instead of saying, what are you painting, you might say, oh, I like what you're painting there. What I like the broad strokes that you're using. You might describe the colors to them. So you try to keep it, like, very open. And that's a Bank Street technique of just encouraging children to kind of focus on the process and develop language around what they're doing. And so with open-ended technology projects, there's also kind of some questions you can keep in your mind that influence the language that you use around technology projects. So here's a few big ideas to hit upon with tech projects. And these are big ideas both for us and for our kids. And like I said, you don't have to hit on every single one of these every single time. These are just things to think about, to have in the back of your mind when you're doing a technology project with your child, that these are areas where they struggle. So the first one is information on the internet is created by people, and people make mistakes or have an agenda. So that's the transparency issue they struggle with. So, for example, if you're in the middle of activity and you feel that the information that you and the child are looking at maybe is not a really great source or super factual source, it's an opportunity to start asking them questions that could lead them to this understanding. Like, who do you think put this information up? Do you think they have a certain idea behind it? Do you think it's the only way of looking at it? So think about questions that could help them come to this understanding themselves. So some of it can be very explicit, and some of it can be more guided questions from you during the project. Another question, another area to think about is just because it's on the internet, just because it's not on the internet doesn't mean it doesn't exist. So this is a really important part for transparency and participation, which means a lot of times in technology projects, if we don't find it, we kind of treat that as a dead end rather than as an opportunity to create it. So when we're trying to find things on the internet and we don't see it, instead of saying, well, we haven't found it, it must not be there, we can say, well, it's not there. Why isn't it there? Who needs to put these things up? Could we put it up? Is an opportunity for, if we know this or if we have something that we contribute, can we put it up? And that could be, I have a few examples of videos and things that my daughter and I have done together, and she's a very small project on this area in the next few slides. So this also leads into the idea that if something isn't on the internet, it's not a dead end. And that's a really, really important point, too, for participation transparency. The internet isn't the be-all, end-all. The internet is created by people, And if we can't find it there, that's okay. You know, it doesn't mean it doesn't exist. And that seems like a very basic concept, but a lot of young learners stop there. And I want to say it was a recent graduation speech at Harvard where someone said, if you're going to do intense journalistic research in modern day, how would you do it? Like, the number one answer was Google. And so even learners 18 to 22 years old are still thinking the internet is the first place you go and the last place you go for information. If it's not there, there's really not much else you can do. And that's a very skewed idea of like kind of how the internet represents the world rather than the world is completely encapsulated within the internet. Another important point for young learners to think about is that I can share things I create and others might learn from it. And this goes back to that participation gap. So rather than constantly just taking things and looking at things that other people have made, really young learners can develop the opportunity to start sharing things that they've made. And there's value in the work they've created for other people. And I'll give you some specific examples of that in the following slides. Another big concept is people think about the world in different ways, and that impacts the ways they describe, categorize, and display information on the internet. So this is transparency. So sometimes you're looking for something on the internet and you just can't find it. And then there's an opportunity for you and the child you're working with to say, well, why can't we find it? So let's think about what words the person would have used who might have been sharing this information. Because it really comes into play regional descriptions of content. So, you know, New York, I think they call them roly-polies, and where I'm from they call them cement bugs. It's the same thing. It's a little tiny bug that rolls up when you touch it when on the ground. Now, if I'm looking for cement bugs and somebody else put it up under roly-poly, we're not going to find the same piece of information. So it's a neat opportunity to start saying, okay, well, we think of it as this way. Are there other ways that people might describe the thing we're looking for, and how can we start searching for it using the language that the person who created the content might be using? Another big thing is that for the participation gap is I don't have to use a website or tool the way it was intended. I can play and create. So even though we tend a big challenge at digital, you know, quote unquote digital natives face, is they know exactly how to use the tool in a very narrow band. So they know how to use YouTube just to find a video. They know how to use Facebook just to post one thing. They know how to use Instagram just to post a picture. So they know how to use it in the one way that they understand how to use it, but they don't really go outside of the normal boundaries and start using it in other ways. And I'll have a couple of specific examples of that, but they don't think of uploading a video, for example, off the bat. They just think of using it in a very one-dimensional way. And then the next two are more about ethics. We won't go deeply into these. I just wanted to bring them up, which is that things that exist on the internet might belong to someone else, and I can't claim them as my own. So that's a really tough thing for a lot of young learners to understand. Is just because it's there and it's digital doesn't mean it's always free from the idea of ownership. So copyright and somebody else having it and your inability to just claim it as yours, that's a really, really high-level concept. For very young children, a good analogy is you wouldn't take somebody else's picture that they painted and put your name on it. So when they're doing research, we talk about that a lot, is how it, you know, more emotional, how it makes you feel if you did all that work and somebody just printed it out and said it was theirs. So we try to really make connections to the fact that this information comes from a person. We really should acknowledge their role in creating it. Another ethics challenge that very young children experience is that people on the internet are real, and I have to interact with them as I would in real life. And this is a huge ethics challenge that leads to a lot of bullying. If for some reason children, they've done a lot of research, and adults tend to very easily disconnect from the fact that the person that they're talking to in an online environment is not a real person. So they are very easily dehumanized the people they interact with. And that's an important part to constantly remind young learners or learners of any age that, you know, every single person you come in contact with is a person. We should always remember those like social norms we have in face-to-face interactions apply to our online spaces as well. Those two are a little bit outside the bounds of what we'll be exploring in the next slides, but I did want to bring them up because they are a really big challenge. And this one's really, really important, and I bring this up for you as well as for your children. You can't break the internet, so just keep on experimenting. That's a really important part of it, participation. A lot of things that keep us from really going, you know, hog wild, for lack of a better word, is our fear that we might break something or might ruin something. But, I mean, it's not going to happen. So you can experiment, you can play around with it, and if you lose your work, you can start over again. But it's not the end of the world, so you really try to get over that barrier of fear of experimenting and breaking something. It's all digital. You can always have a backed up copy and you can always start again. And I found when working with my young learners, having copies of work and saving things and knowing that if they messed up, we can always go back to an older version was very powerful for them. It wasn't the end of the world if we made a mistake. So I want to show you a few, what I'm going to call framework activities, that I have about four of them, that highlight a few of these different concepts in a way that, you know, technology that grows, technology that's open-ended, technology that provides the opportunity for you to kind of ask more deeper questions that get them to the understanding of how the Internet works and how they can contribute to it. So rather than saying here's, you know, Google Maps and here's how you use Google Maps, I want to have tell you a few stories about how I've used it in different ways and how a very simple tool like Google Maps can be open-ended enough to do a wide variety of projects. So a lot of people aren't aware, and if you are aware, I'd love for you to share this in the chat, that it's possible to create your own maps in Google Maps. So this goes into that idea of we tend to use technology only in the way that we know how to use it, and many users see Google Maps as a way to go and get directions. So I go from point A to point B, or I can look at satellite images. But this whole hidden world of there is a way to create my own personal maps, and I can actually put little pins on the map and put information on the map, and I can share the map with others, is a piece that a lot of people aren't aware of. So I want to explore that a little bit with you. And all the links to get to these are included at the end of the presentation. So this goes into the idea of I can share things I create and others can learn from it, so participation. So a little project, and I didn't give you the actual project here, but I did a mock-up to show you an activity I did with my three-year-old. In Google Maps, and I wish I had a pointer, and Judith, there is a pointer, please let me know. I'm trying to put a little pointer on the screen so people can see it.
There is a pointer. Sorry, Jeannie. On the upper left of the screen, there's an arrow.
There, can you guys see me pointing now? Did it pop down?
Yes, we can see it.
Awesome, thank you. Just wanted to double check. So on Google Maps, you can, when you create a new map, and all the instructions about really the nitty-gritty of how to do this, very straightforward, are included in a link at the end of this presentation. You can drop these little red dots, and these are called pins. Now, with my three-year-old, she was really excited about documenting our duck pond visits and duck sightings. So we went in and we dropped a pin at Van Cortlandt, and we dropped a little pin just north of us. There's a little duck pond more towards her grandmother's house. Now, at first, you're like, okay, I dropped two pins. What's the big deal? Well, first, she knows she can actually impact the map, which is really neat and powerful. But then within these pins, you can actually label them, add an image or video, and add text. So you can actually create a little mini experience around each of these points on the map. So the map has just become very personal and very interactive with a few very simple steps. And it illustrates the idea of the interaction between the real world and the digital world. So the pictures are pictures that we actually took, we uploaded and put into the map. And it also emphasizes this idea that just because it doesn't exist doesn't mean I can't create it. So originally we were looking for the best areas to visit duck pond. And, you know, there was no map for that. So we said, well, why don't we create the map? Because we go and visit duck pond. And it was this really neat activity where we were doing something on our day-to-day. We documented it and we shared it. And this is fairly anonymous. You know, there's not a picture of my three-year-old up here. Our names aren't on it. But it's a really neat interaction for the two of us to sit down and have a conversation, even that, you know, she's almost four, to give you an idea of her range. She'll be 4 in March, to say, oh, well, there's a picture I did, and here's the little mark of what we did, and here's that other place we visited. And she saw that she was creating something of her own on the Internet. And that was a big concept for such a young age. And that's a big concept that even more advanced learners don't get. Now, the reason that I say that this sort of technology project can grow with you, I'll go to the next slide. And just to show you, you can actually connect it and create kind of a little path, is you can think about, as students get older, how easily this can become a more and more advanced project. So for very young children, we're documenting the duck pond that we visited. And we talk together, and I'm more the driver. I'm the one typing things, and I'm the one uploading images. And I'm asking her questions, and I'm asking her to talk about what she saw at that duck pond. And if you notice, I go one slide back, you know, we might have put tips in that the ducks don't eat near that particular bridge. Don't bother throwing bread in there. And it was great. We had this whole dialogue while creating the technology together. But as they get older, it's so open-ended they could do anything. They could do a research project around, you know, American Revolution battles in Kingsbridge, and they can put all the documentation of what the pictures look like now, what the pictures look like then, and there's a huge variety of activities that you can do within this simple thing of creating a map with pins and images for pretty much any content in interest area you want. So it could be historic reflections, it could be best places to do an area of interest for a child of any age, and when they're very young, you're the driver. You're the one actually driving the technology, and they're driving the interest. And as they get older, your presence fades a little bit, and then they start to be more of the controller of where the technology goes, and they can actually do it more on their own. So they don't grow out of the technology. They actually grow into it. And that's a really important part, this idea of it growing with them and them growing into the ability to be more independent with it. And the cool thing with these maps, you can share this link with anybody. So after you've created the map of your choice, there is a link that you can share with, you know, your classmates, you can share with grandparents, you can share with other people who share a very specific interest area. And this is something that as your young children get a little bit older and they start using the internet to connect with people who are sharing similar areas of interest, then these are ways for them to share what they've created around those areas, you know, skateboarding parks. You know, I can imagine any of the interests your children have, this could be a really great way to kind of demonstrate and create a very useful resource for their peers. Does anybody have any questions about just how this is an open-ended activity, how it grows with your children, and kind of the idea behind this or more specific uses for this both in and out of school, or does that seem pretty clear? So another example. Oh, thanks, Miriam said it. I never thought to do this. Yeah, I stumbled upon the creation of maps a few years ago, and the more you do it, the more it makes sense. And it's really neat. It's one of the things that kind of you pull back the curtain, and there's just almost a limitless amount of things you can do. I often compare this to blocks. You know, like there's no limit to what you can do with a set of blocks. And if you find the right open-ended tool online, you should have that same kind of like joyous experience of creation as well. So another big concept that I like to think about is if I can't find it, I can create it. So it's transparency and participation. And this is why when the words and the phrases and the questions we use around technology and even the modeling and the conversation we have with our children when we're using technology is so very important. So the example I use is I go back to my daughter because she's 4. We do a lot of these things together just on the fly project. And she was looking for a video on a kneeling bus. Now, as a non-native New Yorker, I did not know that they were called kneeling buses. And she wanted basically, she had been talking to her cousin about the buses that beep in New York City. And he didn't know what she was talking about. And I didn't know really how to describe it. So we said, oh, we'll just go find a video about it. So we searched 15 different things, a New York City bus beeping sound. Couldn't find it. And I turned to her, and she looked at me, and I said, well, it's not here. And she said to me, but I know I've seen it. So it was that really great moment of, all right, so it's not here on the internet, but I know it really exists, so this is not a dead end. And she said, you know, so what's next? And I said, well, why don't we go record a video and show him our own video? So from there, we could have put it back on YouTube. That part, that follow-up is kind of irrelevant at that really young age. But the understanding that, oh, it's not there, I don't have to stop. Now this is rather than a dead end, it's more of an opportunity, which is a really neat shift in thinking for very young children. Now, this is a fairly popular activity, and this is something that I would be very hesitant to do with my own child because it's so public. But there is, some of you may have heard of Super Awesome Sylvia. She's a young girl who, I think she started when she was 7 or 8. She had these questions about technology and science, and none of the videos that she found really answered her questions for science experiments. She could not find something that was kid-friendly, something that answered her questions, so she and her dad started making these videos. So she conducts these experiments, and she shares them with the world about crazy putty and rockets and all these other things. This is an example of somebody who's really embraced kind of this participation culture, and she, you know, realized there was a gap, and she started making them. Now, you don't have to go to the level where your child's face is plastered all over YouTube. I think that might be a little far for a lot of us. An alternative is kind of these how-tos. These two girls, they chose to show their faces here, but they create, and I don't know if any of you have children who do the rainbow loom, they have a huge number of videos just showing you how to create rainbow loom bracelets. So this is more like the 7, 8, 9 range where they know how to do something, and they really want to share with others how to do it. And they made a quick video. Their personal identity is protected because they're not sharing their faces or their names, and they're actually creating it. So they were looking online. They couldn't find any examples of how to create these very intricate works of art. So they said, oh, well, I know how to do it. I can show others how to do it. And it's a really neat shift from consumption to participation. Now, as your children get older, this site is called Animoto, and I included the link at the end. YouTube is a really good resource if you're looking at kind of like, here's a video, you know, go with it. As they develop more complex projects, Animoto, and I encourage you to explore a little bit more on your own. It's very straightforward. You can take pictures, video, all sorts of things that you've done. So you can think about, for a very young child, you've done a family trip. You know, it could be a short trip, it could be a long trip, and you take all of the things that you did during a trip and you put it together, and it has this little icon for a machine, which is pretty appropriate. And then you'd sit together and you put titles and you pick music, and in the end, you have this really beautiful video. And for a 3-year-old, it's a reflection on their trip, and they created it. For an 8-year-old, it might be a more complex summary of a long project or experiment they've been working on. So it's another example of a technology that, for very young users, it's something that you're sitting in the driver's seat. They're putting, you know, they're selecting the media and the words, but you're really the one driving the technology. And for older users, they're already familiar with it, so they can kind of hit the ground running and think of more creative ways to go with it. So another example of I can't find it, I can create it, and you have probably seen this, and this is something you probably do very often, especially if you're educators, the how-to. And, you know, I use the worm composting because one time my daughter and I were looking to do worm composting together, and we often say, how do we do this? And all of these things are created by other people on the Internet. You know, step one, step two, step three with pictures, and we often do these in our classrooms, you know, procedural things for science experiments and whatnot. And I just wanted to just reinforce that any of these things that you see were created by other people. So a really nice emphasis to instill in your young learners is if you see something and you think you can do it better, that's an opportunity to do it better. So rather than be frustrated by, you know, that was very unclear, I didn't understand it, I had a hard time with it, and if they feel like they could create a better model, that in and of itself is a really great opportunity for them to start participating in that way. So if they come across these how-to sites, which is something that young learners, especially the 7 to 10 range, like how do I do this, is a very popular Google search. How do I do insert phrase? Rather than them thinking the only thing they can do is consume the instructions of others, is for them to actually be part of that culture of putting up their knowledge on the web for other people to learn from. I have just a few more, and I feel badly because I have so many, so I don't want to brush over them, but I will try to get these last few in here. The ones we were talking about before are more performance-based, such as, you know, video, sharing knowledge, those sorts of things. A big question I always get is it worth students learning how to code HTML? That comes up a lot, especially with very young learners, even 5, 6. You've probably seen a growing movement here in New York City, you know, teach your children how to code 5, 6, 7, or 8 years old. And people say, what's the real point in that? And this website I'm showing you is called Mozilla Symbol. And along the left, it's basically very basic HTML. And along the right is what that looks like. So I have make something amazing, and I have it bolded, and it pops up over here. And the idea is to show children and young learners essentially how a website is composed. And the real underlying theme of that is you, as you start building things on the web, you understand that the web is created by people, and that makes you more aware and more critical of the information on the web. So I think this is a very neat little tool, which I've included instructions more into, and you'd be amazed as your children get older, even if you don't know how to use it, they're very willing to experiment with it. It's a really great tool for them to kind of have that epiphany of, oh, I just made a very simple website, and I put it up online. That's how websites get online. All of these things are created by people, and it's the people who create the information who may or may not have all the facts or who may have a certain point of view. And there's so many great questions that you can come around with this where they put something on their website and you say, well, where did you get that information? Do you think there's other ways of looking at it? Do you think that you should present this as a fact or opinion? Think about the other people looking for the content. Can you direct them to other sources? And this is a really good conversation starter for them to be more critical of their own research process, the things that they encounter, knowing that it was all created by other people and knowing how those people created it, I think is a hugely important part of that transparency part of the web. There's two other quick sites that I want to show you. One of them is Mozilla Popcorn Maker, and I really, really like this site. And many of you have probably used iMovie or something similar to iMovie to create class projects. And this is a web-based version of that. So essentially what you end up with is an online site where you can bring in images, text, video, Wikipedia articles, anything you want, and you end up with almost like a movie editor. So you can drag all of these things along the right into this kind of whiteboard space and create a whole new thing. And this idea of remix is a fairly new concept, but the idea that you take things that already exist on the web, you pull them in, and you reorganize them in a way to show your understanding of something. And that's a really nice thing because if you're doing projects, Alana asked if the same as Glogster. I'm not super familiar with Glogster, to be honest, but I can follow up afterwards. I think there's two questions I had, one about the Kindle reading and Glogster, the other one that I don't want to say yes or no because I've never used Glogster, but I can give you a definitive answer after the webinar when I send that email to Judith. So the idea with this is you can take things on their web, and the nice thing is sometimes when you're working on YouTube or other sites like that, you have to create everything yourself. So you have to be next to a bus in order to get the bus, and you have to be very, very first person. This one, it lets you take all the videos out there and kind of jam them together in a new way. So it's more about experimenting and sampling and repositioning and adding your own explanation rather than trying to develop all the primary sources yourself. So what are the ethical concerns? That's a really great question that just came up. So the ethical concerns around copyright. I actually worked very closely with the people who created this, with Mozilla, and they do this in a really interesting way. So legally, it's not copyright violation because they're not actually making copies of anything. So all of these, when they link to something, if you click on the duck image, for example, there's a little thing that pops up that shows you exactly where it came from. So every single piece of content that you have in here links back to the original piece. So it's all referenced, and you can't make copies of it. Essentially, it's just like an embedded version of that. I'm trying to think of the least technical way to explain it, but essentially they say, well, here's a duck video, and you mouse over, and here's where it came from. So it has automatic attribution built in. So as soon as you bring it over, you know exactly where it came from. So they really discourage you downloading it onto your computer and then trying to put it back up. They more encourage you linking to it, and that way you get in the habit of showing where you got things. So it's kind of built-in part of the process. Now, as far as you as an individual saying, citation not necessary. You like that? Yeah, that's exactly it. So we had a commenter say that, you know, not necessarily having to do citation. It's built-in citation, and it really gets students in the habit instead of taking things off the internet, putting them on the computer, and then I think of iMovie as an example, and then putting them into another container, and they've lost where it's come from as part of that process. This actually requires you to just put the link of where you got it from, and it'll show you the content, but it's constantly asking you, well, where did it come from? And it kind of helps lead you to think that, oh, these things are coming from places, and I'm just by default doing attribution. One example I saw, an older child did a project with this, and just an example of an idea of remix as a form of expression and participation, is there was, I'm sure many of us are familiar with Black Friday and the Black Friday, I'm trying to think of the Black Friday mobs, you know, like the people running and the people, you know, jumping and things like that. And a student had taken this various images of newscasts of all the things happening with Black Friday and then put along the bottom a song about holiday spirit, like a very poignant song about holiday spirit. So they use it as an opportunity to kind of express an opinion just by putting together things that already exist on the web in a new way that showed something that they were thinking about. So this is a really neat opportunity. Rivka asks, is it similar to creating a PowerPoint that's animated? It is in a way. The biggest difference I would say is that it lives on the web. So PowerPoint, you're going to be pulling down things and then putting them in, so you lose that opportunity for automatic attribution. And with this, you have a little bit more control. I'm sorry, not control. It's more kid-friendly. So you could do the PowerPoint animated. I find the drag-and-drop interface an easy way to put text in here. And you can do embedded YouTube videos. It's much more streamlined for young learners. I would say if you were older and very comfortable with copyright issues, then PowerPoint would be totally fine. But with the younger learners, especially like the 5 to 10 range, I found that this tool was much easier to navigate for them. And I think I have one more, and I know I have just a few minutes for questions. The last one is I Can Play and Create, and this is a participation one. And some of you may recognize this. This is Scratch. And this is a neat, neat program, and I've used this with children as young as 4 and 5. And what it does is it teaches them how web and game works. So you have this little guy, he's a cat, and it could be anything. It could be any figure you've put in there. And you essentially have a set along the right of what they call events. So when this happens, something else should happen. So you can say, when this happens, play a sound. When this happens, play a drum. And the really cool thing about this, with it, you know, when this happens, turn 15 degrees, the really cool thing about this is all the pieces fit together like a puzzle. So you can't put things together that don't work together. So I drag down when, you know, the green flag is clicked, then I want to play the meow sound, and I want the cat to move 10 steps, and I want to repeat it. And the cool thing that I really like about this Scratch program and why I suggest it for young children is it's a way for them to start thinking about if then statements, which is a really foundational part of programming later on. So if I do something, then something else will happen as a result. And that's exactly how the entire internet is built. So when you go on a website and you use your mouse to click on something, somebody somewhere has written, if somebody clicks on this, then launch this website. And so it really helps them understand kind of the mechanics of how our entire internet works. And so they start with something that's very drag and drop and very structured, and through that eventually grow to the understanding that pretty much everything that they interact with digitally is all constructed by this idea of when something happens, something else happens as a result. And it's a really nice way for them to get that transparency. But then just on a purely fun level, there's so many things you can do with this. I've seen fourth graders create extremely complex games where you can use the, you know, the mouse keys and move things around. And so this is something that grows with children from a basic understanding of, you know, some things cause other things to a larger, more complex understanding of just like game mechanics and internet mechanics. So I like to put this on the end so you kind of have a scope of the children who are more interested in sharing along the map. So the more like the historical and social children, you might have more the visual and children who want to share art projects and how-tos. You might have children who are more interested in the mechanics of how it works, the more mathematical elements behind all the programs we use. And then you also might have the children who want to look at things on the web and display them in a new way, and that would be the remixing element. So I wanted to just point out that I have links to all the things I've talked about, and unfortunately, I'm sorry I went so long. I don't have a ton of time for questions, so I do want to open it up now for questions. It's a lot of information, and I do really want you to think of this as more a framework to think about technology rather than a how-to guide for specific websites.
Jeannie, thank you so much for such a powerful presentation that such great theoretical context and really practical ways to implement it. While people are thinking of questions, if you have a question, you can type it in the chat room. If you'd like to ask it over the phone, you can click on the hand raise symbol, and we will unmute your phone. While people are thinking about these questions, I want to announce upcoming webinars for parents on January 13th. Sibling sniping, bedtime battles, homework hassles, are we having fun yet? And the presenter is not Meryl Silver. There's a little bit of an error there. The presenter is Joanna Faber. And then the following webinar will be February 4th for teachers and parents promoting social skills and social growth with Dr. Rona Novick. So in order to get more information or register, you can go to the Hidden Sparks website, hiddensparks.org. And I am just scrolling up to see if there are any hands raised. Not yet. Feel free again to type a question in. I'm sorry,
I just run around to the group.
Jeannie was having some trouble breathing. She's pregnant she had a foot pressing in her lungs. So, Jeannie, I hope you're okay now.
I'm totally fine. So I just wanted to say, if you heard the heavy breathing or like the long pauses, I apologize, because there's a battle halfway through there between me and a tiny, tiny foot.
Well, I hope you both win. I also want to, can I just give one more reminder?
Of course.
Participants, you are going to get an email with a survey evaluation. Please fill it out. It really does help us. And you can download this webinar, watch it, listen to it at any time, or anyone else who has internet access after about 24 hours. On the screen now is Jeannie's contact information and the Hidden Sparks office as well. Jeannie, you wanted to say something. I'm sorry, I cut you off.
Yep, I was just going to say that, you know, it was so much information at the end, really more about the framework and specific technologies. So if anyone struggles a little bit with getting started, they can feel free to contact me at the information at the address provided, because it was more of a moose boosh, as they say, a little taste of those specific ones more than in-depth. And I don't want anybody to feel intimidated getting into it. So please reach out to me if you do need help with those. And I'll also, the two questions that were asked about, I think, Grobster, could somebody please repeat it? I'm sorry, my brain stopped for a second. I know about
Glogster.
The reading time. Thank you, and Glogster. I will send you the answer to those questions probably tomorrow, that if you can just send to the group. I would really appreciate that.
That's great. I'll forward it on to Margaret. She can send it out to everyone. That would be great. And there is a question, do most schools introduce technologies to the kids? Why or why not?
Well, you know, it's a really good question. It depends on who you have in the school. So there's a couple different camps. So at Bank Street, they don't introduce technology to children, I think, even up until, I want to say, what would be the equivalent of second or third grade. So 7s, 8s, 8s, 9s, I think, is around the age they start doing it. And before, they focus almost exclusively on peer-to-peer social interactions and, more physical development. I think what really comes into it is whether or not you have the framework to introduce it meaningfully. And that's the challenge, where a lot of schools have the technology, but they don't necessarily have a guiding idea of how to use it meaningfully with young children, like this idea of passive versus active. So it ends up being perhaps, you know, children going on to one website and clicking a button for 2 hours, and that's not a super meaningful experience for young children. And then it becomes kind of a tension with the parents and the teachers. Well, why are we using this time? There's better ways to use the time. So it really depends upon how developed their understanding is of these concepts and how to implement them with young children is about whether or not that will be successful. I know that's kind of a roundabout way of saying it, but I find that schools sometimes just err on the side of no technology rather than implementing it in a way that's not thoughtful and promoting of a constructivist perspective.
Jeannie, thank you. Thank you so much. Really, I'm just going to speak personally. You've helped me kind of reframe how I think about my participation on the internet. And it's a really fantastic, I really like the way you organized everything. So thank you so much.
Oh, you're very welcome. And there's a few more questions I'll just answer in chat really quickly. I'm going to hang up my phone so I can breathe for a little bit. And then if anybody has the last few more questions, I'll just type them in chat. And thank you all for taking the time this evening with me and with the Hidden Sparks team. We really appreciate it.
Thank you. So I'm just going to repeat, Jeannie was saying that she's going to answer in the chat room. So she's not going to be speaking anymore, but she will. If you have any more questions, you can type them in and she will respond through typing. I also want to thank Betsy, who always makes things run so, so very smoothly. And thank you to all the participants who really contributed with their questions and comments. It was a very interesting window to see what people were thinking about. Thank you so much, and feel free to stay on as Jeannie types more in, as more questions come in. Thank you very much to everyone, and have a wonderful night.